joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Many economists are calling on consumers to take a deep breath. The current economy is not really all that bad, they say. But a weak job market, rising food and gas prices, and the ongoing credit crisis have put a damper on hopes for a speedy uptick. A bank failure in California last week has raised a whole new set of concerns. Joining me in the studio to talk about the health of the banking industry and its impact on the economy, former Congressman Jim Leach of Iowa. He's now director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Bert Ely, he's a financial services industry consultant, and Kathleen Day from the Center for Responsible Lending. Throughout the hour, I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Before we begin our conversation with our guest here in the studio, we're joined by phone from Miami, Robert Hartheimer. He's former director of the Division of Resolutions at the FDIC from 1991 to 1995. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us. Do we have Mr. Hartheimer with us?
Yes, good morning.
Thank good you morning, me. Sir. I'm glad you're with us. Explain what happened with IndyMac last week.
Well, let me do that, but I think I want to give a little perspective.
All right.
Appreciate that IndyMac is timely and in the news, but I think it needs to be thought about in the broader context of the industry and what the agency and the banking regulators have done over their the last 20, 30, 40
well,
years.
Well, I'm not going to have time to go over the whole
history. I understand.
But I do need to hear your view on IndyMac.
That's fine. What, my view on IndyMac, and it really, from an agency standpoint, I've seen in the press comments about what was the FDIC doing in advance of this failure, what were the primary regulators doing, and the FDIC is an insurance company. It's not like Allstate waiting for a call after the house is burned down.
I understand.
It is well aware ahead of time of a bank that's under stress, and the examiners were dispatched at that institution well ahead of time. The examiners, as the panelists know, have many enforcement tools, and those tools are used frequently and not necessarily made public. All options are on the table with these enforcement tools to encourage a bank to fix its problems, raise capital, exit businesses, enhance liquidity. And as with IndyMac, if all options are exhausted, the FDIC goes into a well-planned resolution process. And so what the FDIC did as it relates to IndyMac, it started at some point in June as this bank went on the projected troubled bank list. The FDIC began to gather the latest financial information. They brought together their experts to determine the best way to transfer deposits and sell assets. They were in the process of contacting potential buyers. In a resolution, you actually sell a company, and you do it very privately without the public's knowledge of it.
Now, we have heard, Bob Hartheimer, that there are reports of possible fraud and that IndyMac since it was the second largest bank failure in the U.S. A source with knowledge of that investigation says the federal government is looking into whether the bank engaged in fraud when it made home loans to high-risk borrowers. Can you comment?
I don't have specific knowledge, but it is not unusual that banks that fail are reviewed for fraudulent activity. It would be consistent with what's happened in past bank failures over the years. In the case of IndyMac, what you had is you had a liquidity failure that actually abbreviated the FDIC's process, and they created a conservatorship, a bridge bank, a new bank to hold the deposits until they can be transferred to a bank on the West Coast that would be interested in buying them. Traditionally, the agency does not do bridge banks unless they feel that there is a need to protect depositors and to protect the insurance fund. In this case, they were in the middle or had begun a process to sell this bank in a private manner and to transfer the deposits at the time that the bank would fail. But that changed with the liquidity crisis. And I guess the point that I think to me is miraculous and is that this was a $32 billion institution. It had 33 branches, and it was closed on a Friday and opened up on a Monday. And in the private sector, I mean, this was akin to an acquisition, and there's a tremendous amount of work that went into both the planning and the execution of this transfer.
Well, the question becomes, to what extent do you believe that the situation with IndyMac was an anomaly or may represent the banking industry as a whole?
We've experienced a 10 plus year period of relatively few bank failures, but if you look at the history of the FDIC, there's something over 3,300 banks that have failed since 1934, and I think that you're going to see ebbs and flows of bank failures. But the good news is this country has an agency that all it does is protect depositors, and it has the ability to handle banks the size of IndyMac or even larger or even smaller. When I was at the agency from 1992 to 96, 200 banks failed with about $50 billion in assets. That's a lot of logistics, and the agency met the challenge. I believe the agency will be able to meet the challenge going forward. IndyMac, may be an anomaly, may not be an anomaly. I'm not sure that it makes a difference to the marketplace because depositors will not lose money.
Robert Hartheimer, he's former director of the Division of Resolutions at the FDIC. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And turning to you now, Bert Ely, how would you assess the financial strength of U.S. banks today?
The U.S. banking industry as a whole is in very strong condition. It's well capitalized. There are some problems. There is going to be an increase over the next couple of years from the very low level of failures we've had in recent years. But there are going to be far fewer failures than there were in the 1980s and early 1990s, in part because banks are better capitalized and also because of the regulation of banks is much stronger than it was at that time. With regard to IndyMac, that was very much an anomaly within the banking industry. It had grown very rapidly in the last year. It had engaged in extremely high-risk mortgage lending. Quite frankly, I think the regulators were slow to pick up on its problems. But IndyMac is not an indication of what we're going to see broadly across the banking industry.
And Congressman Leach, you said that it's the bigger banks that are actually having more trouble. Why is that?
Well, basically speaking, banking strength is often in inverse proportion to size. The smaller banks are better capitalized than the large banks. Large banks have operated on thinner capital, partly because they've had a wider variety of products and serve a wider variety of industries. But today, the small banks are actually in a little better shape. They have better ties to communities. And so some of your larger institutions, especially those that have a single purpose like Fannie Mae and Freddie Bank, who aren't commercial banks but are part of the banking system itself, are in difficulty. Plus, some of your largest banks that have found themselves in very competitive market niches are seeing some stress, but they at least have the advantage of being able to sell stock on a quicker basis than a smaller institution and therefore have some recapitalization prospects out of an easier basis than a smaller institution.
And Kathleen Day, what does all this mean for the consumer?
Well, I first of all, I want to say I agree with my two colleagues here mostly, except I just want to say one thing. To Bert's characterization that this is not endemic, I do think that the banking system as a whole is reasonably sound, but I do think that IndyMac is representative of the kind of unfair and deceptive and irresponsible practices that were going on in the subprime market. So I do think that it is representative of that. If the problem is to get to the bottom of this and find out when are prices going to stop going down so that credit can start being extended. Consumers will be all right, but I mean, it's going to be harder to borrow money.
Kathleen Day at the Center for Responsible Lending. We'll take a short break. The phones are open. Join us on 800-433-8850. Welcome back. As we talk about the U.S. banking industry with three individuals, former congressman from Iowa, Jim Leach, Bert Ely, a consultant, and Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Joyce in Arizona, who says, given the way the Bush administration has twisted the facts on everything from war to science, why on earth should I trust the spokesman who say, don't worry, FDIC will cover your deposits up to $100,000. As the dollar's current value continues to plummet, would I be wise to convert my cash to gold and bury it in the backyard? Kathleen Day.
Well, I don't want to give investment advice, but I'm probably safe to say people should probably not be digging, putting their savings
in the backyard. But how secure should investors, how secure should people who have their money in banks feel right now?
Well, they first of all, the FDIC is an independent agency. So and the banking it and it's done that way on purpose. So regardless of who's in the White House, regardless of what happens, they have a responsibility that Congress has given them. Even though there's a board now that was constituted, does have the Treasury on it and has a lot of people there. In part, but in reaction to the savings and loan crisis of 20 years ago, that was so that this wouldn't happen again. Of course, it has happened again because the other bank regulators, once again, confused supervision with regulation. If you deregulate, you have to have some more cops on the beat to make sure people aren't abusing their new freedoms and privileges.
The question becomes, with the FDIC insuring deposits up to $100,000, what percentage of deposits currently in banks are uninsured? Bert Ely.
That percentage is somewhere in the range of 35%. Don't hold me on that exactly. First of all, large corporations hold substantial uninsured deposits, and comfortably so. In banks, even smaller banks have lots of uninsured deposits because the banking system is sound. I'd like to come back to the lady's concerns about deposit insurance. Because of the S&L crisis, Congress explicitly placed the full backing of the federal government behind federal deposit insurance, and not only gave that, but it gave the FDIC the unlimited authority to tax healthy banks to pay for bank failures. The banking industry is going to pay $4 to $8 billion to cover the estimated loss in IndyMac, and they'll continue to pay for the other losses. So it's a combination of the FDIC's ability to tax the banking industry and the backing of the U.S. Treasury, ultimately the U.S. taxpayer, that makes federal deposit insurance up to the insurance limits very, very sound.
Congressman Lage.
Well, perspective, let me tag on to Bert for a second. All the money in the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has been provided by banks implicitly through fees, which what might be described, as Bert does, as a tax. But your Congress is going to back the system even if it goes beyond the losses that are currently considered conceivable. With the S&L failure in the 1980s, what was then the Federal Savings and Loan Investment Corporation Fund was inadequate for the circumstance. Congress stepped in and applied another over $100 billion short-term, $300 or $400 billion over the long-term to pay that off.
At the same time, we've seen depositors go to IndyMac's door receiving the full $100,000. But anything over that, they were paying what, 50 cents or 75 cents on the dollar, Kathleen?
They might have to wait to get something over that, but they're going to get it. The fact is that the government is not going to let people, especially in a shaky environment like this, it's going to make people whole. You'd really... things would even have to get worse than this, and it's hard to conceive that they could. They're going to make people whole because they want to keep confidence in the system high. The worst thing anyone could do is erode confidence further. These people are a generation that have not seen a bank run. They're going to see that it is not the end of the world. They're going to get their money.
Bert.
In the IndyMac situation, the FDIC is making an additional distribution or dividend, as they call it, of 50% to the uninsured depositors. But as the FDIC liquidates the bank over the next few years, there will be additional distributions to the uninsured depositors. Based on the loss estimates we've seen, they probably will ultimately get back about 70 to 80 cents on the dollar.
All right, let's talk about the reluctance or limited ability of banks to make new loans to affected consumers. You're concerned about that, Jim Lage.
Well, what you have is a duality circumstance. The economy depends on banks. The banks depend on the economy. And we're in unprecedented economic times. And so there are some uncertainties out there. And to deny the uncertainties would be putting one's head in the sand. Banks are taking fairly prudent approaches to lending at the moment. If the economy stabilizes, some of those prudential steps will probably be eased a bit, but vice versa. And so we're in a difficult time. This is not a time to over-leverage in anyone's advice to anybody doing anything. By the same token, your banking system is fortunately, and I say very fortunately, on the whole, quite strong.
You know, there were there was much criticism coming from various corners in regard to a letter that Congressman Chuck Schumer sent to IndyMac expressing concern about what was going on with its lending processes, what was going on with its holdings. An awful lot of people are blaming Chuck Schumer for what happened to IndyMac, Kathleen. How do you see it?
The fact is that the stock of IndyMac had fallen substantially well before Chuck Schumer, that letter was made public. And the fact is that it's anyone who's pointing a finger at him is really is merely trying to deflect attention from the fact that it's the bad loans and irresponsible behavior that got IndyMac in trouble. As the gentleman from the FDIC said, the FDIC was in there well before. They knew they had a problem. So by making it public, did it bring it to a head sooner? Maybe, but it was inevitable. I mean, this was a problem bank.
Birdie Lee.
Yes, it clearly was a problem bank. Although the FDIC did not list it as one or did not include it on its problem bank list as of March 31, which is an indication they were moving slowly. The damage caused by...
Maybe too slowly? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, they moved too slowly. But that being said, Senator Schumer's letter had the effect of triggering a run over 2 weeks on the bank. According to the regulators, IndyMac lost 7% of its deposits. I think the letter was inappropriate in terms of being made public. Certainly appropriate for Senator Schumer to communicate privately to the regulators. It is likely, although we'll never know for certain, that his letter and the subsequent run triggered a premature closing of IndyMac, which led to some of the chaotic situation we saw earlier this week. This was not handled in the best possible manner, as the earlier gentleman had talked about. And hopefully we won't see something like this happen again.
Congressman Leach, let's talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what you see happening there. How concerned should we as ordinary citizens be regarding the health of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what the government might do to support those institutions?
Well, this is a profoundly... disturbing circumstance, but that does not mean that the country needs to worry a great deal about the basis of the American mortgage market. What it has to think through is how the government should respond to declining values of homes, which then reflects on the assets of institutions that deal with home loans. And Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are the two largest dealers in home loans with $1.5 trillion worth of loans they own themselves, and $3.5 trillion or more than that of loans that they've guaranteed. And so, as the home values decline, the asset values of these institutions weaken. And then the question becomes: how, in a regulatory sense, can you maintain their viability, and how do you deal with the future? My own sense is that the Treasury and the Fed are correct in suggesting that we ought to move quickly and powerfully.
To do what?
To make it clear that these institutions will not fail.
How?
In this case, they're offering lines of credit. But from the Treasury's perspective, that involves a need for legislation. And in this regard, I think Congress is right not to necessarily give a blank check to the framework that the Treasury has put forth, because it involves... a free ride basically for the shareholders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And in my view, there ought to be some quid pro quos. And if we go to past models, and I'm not suggesting it was a wise thing to do, but if you take the Chrysler bailout of the late 1970s or the Mexico bailout of the early 90s, what you had was the United States Treasury play the role of an investment bank for the American public. And so in the Chrysler circumstance, they guaranteed loans, did not extend any money whatsoever to Chrysler, but in guaranteeing the loans, they helped stabilize Chrysler. And for guaranteeing the loans, they got a quid pro quo, which was warrants in Chrysler stock. And in exercising these warrants, which were options to buy stock at a given price, which they were immediately resold in the market, the United States Treasury made several hundred million dollars. Likewise with Mexico, just for the agreement to make a guarantee of loans, they charged a fee, acting as an investment bank, in effect. It made several hundred million dollars. So in both cases, the Treasury, i.e. the public, benefited from the intervention of the United States government in these two circumstances, which may have well have been controversial, but at least they were prudentially done. In this case, if the Treasury of the United States is to extend lines of credit of significant dimensions, and there's a case for that, there ought to be a quid pro quo, which in my view should involve warrants on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stock, and significant warrants, if the circumstance is that dire, to give the possibility that the public itself will benefit for taking on liabilities that advantage one sector of the American economy.
Kathleen.
I agree with that. I think one of the things that you want to avoid here is privatizing the profit so that anytime there's an upside, industry and shareholders get to get that. But then when there's a downside, the taxpayers have to pick up the tab. One of the big problems here with Freddie and Fannie is that the White House, this administration, has allowed them to buy. They were not buying these bad loans in the front end, but they were buying them for their own investment portfolio. In fact, Freddie and Fannie bought one out of every $3 of this garbage subprime stuff, and they have it in their own portfolio. And someone should have questioned that.
Bert?
Well, I think that a key to any kind of resolution of the Fannie-Freddie problem is to force the companies to substantially downsize their balance sheets. As Jim mentioned, they have about $1.5 trillion of debt outstanding with which they've bought mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. They should sell those mortgage-backed securities and securitize those mortgages because that would drop their capital requirement by over half. And I think that is one of the absolutely key steps that must be taken, downsize their balance sheets.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. When you think about what these organizations have done up to now, are there reform measures that could be taken that you think would address the problems that we've seen occur? Bert?
I think one of the most important reform measures is to bring to the United States a mortgage funding technique called covered bonds that's existed very successfully in Europe for over two centuries. There's about $3 trillion of this paper outstanding in Europe, and yet it's hardly known in this country. 2 days ago, the FDIC Board of Directors approved a policy statement that is excessively cautious in terms of opening the market to covered bonds in the United States. But covered bonds would basically allow banks and thrifts to make mortgages, keep them on balance sheets so they don't have to securitize them, and fund them with long-term debt secured by those mortgages.
But didn't some of the European banks have their own problems?
They have had their own problems because they bought mortgage-backed securities.
Issued.
No, and that is a problem. But with regard to the covered bonds they issued to fund their own mortgages, they have held up very well because of the structure of covered bonds. But the thing about what we have in our present system in the United States with all the mortgage securitization is that not only have we seen a lot of risk, but it's also very inefficient because there are a lot of transaction costs associated with it that would not exist if we relied much more on covered bonds to finance home mortgages in the United States.
Jim Leach, what are your thoughts?
Well, on covered bonds, I think that's another option to throw on the table. I don't think it's a panacea. Basically speaking, on the positive side, we have the most efficient mortgage system in the history of man. On the negative side, it's been concentrated in too few places. But I don't think one should look at everything as the glass is half full. Covered bonds are just another option that may or may not make a difference in a few situations. In terms of the future, what is mandatory is that there be regulation that is understandable and prudential and extensive in this particular arena. And what we had with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was two muscular political institutions that ensured that their regulation would be lighter than everybody else's.
I guess what I have a hard time understanding, and perhaps many of our listeners do as well, within each of these, as you call them, muscular institutions, there are individuals. Do individuals bear some responsibility for what's happened here, Kathleen?
Certainly they bear some, but it's also data shows that 6 out of 10 people who got these bad loans would have qualified for a cheaper conventional loan. So that just speaks for itself. Why would 6 out of every 10 people knowingly take on buy something that's tens of thousands of dollars more expensive than another product? They were misled. It was deceptive. So you need to have some rules of the road, some traffic lights, so people understand what they're buying. You can't have a free market if you don't have a free flow of information. But on how to fix this, you have to get a bottom to this market. You have to people have to understand the individual consumer accounts for 70% of economic activity. So with all these lifelines being thrown to the institutions that cause this, you need to help the individuals who are the victims as well.
Kathleen Day of the Center for Responsible Lending. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the American Psychological Association and its 150,000 members, bringing the science and practice of psychology to daily living at apa.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Promising new drugs offer cancer patients hope for survival, but at a steep price. To some, they're an answered prayer. Others worry the drugs' high costs are driving patients and doctors to financial ruin and widening the gap between the insured and uninsured. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to go to the phones as we talk about the banking industry, the mortgage industry, how the two are interconnected, and what solutions may lie ahead. Let's go first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Albert.
Hi, Diane. It's great to be on your show.
Thank you.
Let me make a statement and ask a question
sure.
to your panelists. Many of the financial newsletters that I'm reading in this particular time in our economy are referring to the fact that in the early 80s and then the mid-90s, the Bureau of Labor Statistics have really changed the way they put out the final official CPI or Consumer Price Index number. Many of them are stating that the true inflation rate as we used to look at it pre-1980 is really 12 or 15%. The official one, when you take out the non-core items and make other adjustments, is always being reported at 2 or 3%. It surely gives the Federal Reserve cover to keep interest rates low. My question to your panel is, how has this manipulation of the CPI in order to keep it really low and retard pay rises, for example, for Social Security and federal pensions, how is that damaged? To what degree has that damaged Americans' purchasing power, since that number really denies them a lot of the increases they need to keep up with what you all are talking about right now?
Congressman Leach.
Well, when you do collections of statistics, you can take different models, and some lead to one set of answers, some lead to other sets of answers. It's like Mark Twain's famous comment that there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. And you can organize statistics in various ways. The gentleman is partly correct that you can do different methodologies that lead to a higher inflation denotation. But it's very difficult to organize the exact set of statistics to fit everyone's set of beliefs.
All right. To Indianapolis. Good morning, Judy. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, Diane. I, too, love your show and listen every day.
Thank you so much.
I have a hypothetical question.
Sure.
If half of the banks in the country failed and people wanted to withdraw all their savings, we're assured that the FDIC is going to cover our money for up to $100,000 a person. And I'm wondering, where does the FDIC get this money, and how is that going to affect the U.S. federal budget? Are they going to have to print money in order to pay us what we have in the bank?
All right. Kathleen.
The money that goes into the FDIC has been primarily money that comes from a fee charged on the institutions that hold the money that is insured. So that's where most of it comes from. But if there's a big problem, as we saw in the SNL fiasco, you're going to have to go to the taxpayers. And that happened.
And following up on that, Peter in Fern Park, Florida says, so banks pay a fee to the FDIC to cover depositors. How much of this fee actually covers deposits, and does the taxpayer cover some of it? Bert?
The FDIC has been funded totally by the banks since it was founded in 1934. That continues to be the case. Going back to the earlier question, we're not going to have half the banks fail. That's just not in the cards. But as losses for the FDIC go up, the deposit insurance premiums that the banks pay are going to go up. The banking industry understands this. They're not happy about it, but they will pay those fees. And I frankly do not see in this anything like the environment we have today, there'll be any taxpayer money going into the FDIC.
I think there are a lot of people, Bird, out there a little more pessimistic than our panel here. Here is an email from Mark, who says, I believe your guests are being a bit naive as to the scope of the problem. The home mortgage industry is a total mess. We've yet to see the fallout in the commercial mortgage industry, which is just beginning to unravel. With so many foreclosures, the banks are going to have unprecedented losses in their credit card portfolios as homeowners fall behind on payments. Take note that no banks failed in 2006. Three failed all of last year, but five have failed already in the first half of 2008. We're heading off a precipice, Kathleen.
And don't forget that hundreds of little, or dozens, scores of littler institutions that were not bona fide banks with deposit insurance that were finance company making mortgages did fail. So those need to be taken into account. But just remember, I just have to amend one thing Bert said. I agree with him. Banks have funded this, but in the savings and loan crisis, there wasn't enough money even for the banks to pay it. And Congress did have to authorize hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer money. When you have the Federal Reserve opening the window, discount window, and holding these garbage mortgage-backed securities as collateral, you again raise the specter that it could fall onto taxpayers. So there is that specter. I don't think it will happen, but there is that specter.
And here's a follow-up to that from Brian in Mansfield, Ohio. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. Yeah, my question is, a lot of people don't realize it, but back in the late 90s, the subprime mortgage had a fallout then, too, with companies like First Plus went under. And so my question is you know, with all the problems back then, why wasn't regulations put into effect? And then I think on one of your, I think it was Fresh Air, actually, a guy talked about how there's a last-minute provision put in the late 1990s that, you know, protected from regulations of these kinds of things with these credit default instruments. And when are they going to learn their lesson and understand that these have to be regulated?
Jim.
Well, if we go backwards, other than the huge SNL dilemma that occurred in the early 80s, it's impressive that there have been so few, not so many, defaults. Now, what has happened, that this gentleman mentioned a couple sophisticated financial instruments. Every year, there is a new sophistication in finance that develops that, frankly, can be way faster and quicker than government regulators' capacity to understand. And so I believe the number of mistakes is going to multiply in the future. Now, having said that, to the degree that the economy is stable, I think this is a very manageable circumstance. To the degree that the economy falters, it becomes much severer and much deeper. And so what you're looking at is a circumstance where lack of precedent leads to the only obvious conclusion that nobody knows for sure what is going to happen.
Here's an email from Kimberly in Winston-Salem. How has the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act helped create the mega banks we now see? Too big to fail seems to mean the taxpayer is funding irresponsible practices of many financial institutions. Should the American taxpayer get stock in exchange for these bailouts? It seems to me we as taxpayers are once again being used by the financial elites to fund their party, one to which we are not being invited. Kathleen.
Well, I think the gentleman to my right should answer that. But I don't think it is a problem of deregulation or allowing growth, because I think that legislation has proven to be fine. It was the lack of supervision as banks operated under these new rules that was the problem. But I do agree with her. There's a problem here with privatizing the profits, letting the industry have the party, and then when the party's over, letting the taxpayer pick up for the cleanup. And that is not fair.
And we should recall that it's the same Phil Graham who said the other day that the American public has become a nation of whiners and that the recession is all in our heads. Congressman Leach.
Well, I observe fewer, more foolish comments. And if there is a degree of truth to any aspect of it, it could not be more inappropriate to be uttered. The fact of the matter is that there is an element of psychology to economies, and so confidence factors matter. But the American public on the whole has been a very buoyant public and a very upbeat and optimistic public. Today it's reflecting a bit of pessimism based upon what it's seeing around them. And what it's seeing around them, the public is seeing grounds for realistic concern. And the realistic concern relates to how the average citizen has a harder and harder time making payments. The fact that for the last decade, and it precedes this administration, for the last decade, for the first time in American history, those at the upper ends of the American economy are doing substantially better, relatively speaking, to those at the lower and the middle. And the middle are not rising with the upper. And this means that for many American citizens, one upset, for example, a sickness, for example, a job displacement, it can send family finances in a real tailspin. And then that has magnifying effects on the economy.
Let's go now to Clinton, Connecticut. Mark has a comment very much along those lines. Go right ahead, sir.
Hi, Diane. Good morning.
Hi there.
I want to preface this by saying I am in real estate. I've done extremely well with it. I'm not poor. to blame, there is an overtone of blame on people who took subprime mortgages. First of all, that's not the whole story. Secondly, a lot of those people were misled. In terms of it not being the whole story, when interest rates are artificially forced down, which they were for a long period of time, it's very inflationary. When people skim the profits of that inflation through hedge funds and other instruments, that's where the inflation takes place. And that money has been extracted. The dismissal of your earlier caller that the 13 to 15% interest rate is simply a manipulation of statistics is wrong. Ask the average person how they feel, how much harder they're working, how hard it is, and you'll get your true answer where inflation lies. So what I think is happening here and what was allowed to happen by our government, and it is both a lack of supervision and deregulation, is a huge and unprecedented concentration of wealth. We are not a society with a middle class effectively anymore. Very few people are able to hold on to that, even at my level. It's a struggle.
Bert Healy.
First of all, I agree that the Fed held short-term interest rates too low earlier in this decade. That certainly fed into low interest rates, which allowed for cheaper mortgages. And consequently, we got a tremendous bubble in housing prices, mm-hmm. which had the unfortunate effect of actually reducing housing affordability. What we're going through right now, very painfully, is a very needed and overdue correction in the terms of which credit is granted and in house prices. And we're kind of getting back to more of a norm. And we have to realize that things went to excess, and we're now in the correction period. And it is painful for a lot of people, but unavoidable.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's been said that the subprime housing crisis is going to keep going until prices finally hit some kind of floor. Any predictions from anyone as to when that might be?
Well, I think before that happens, you have to give a lifeline to the people who are victims of this. As Congressman Leach said, obviously these things are tied, the economy to housing. As housing goes down, the economy goes down, the economy goes down, it makes for more foreclosures. Congress needs to do something to help to avoid some of the 2.2 million foreclosures that are going to happen in the next couple of years. One is to put back on the table allowing bankruptcy judges to modify to a fair market value a person's mortgage on their primary residents. Right now, a bankruptcy judge can modify the contract on a vacation home, a yacht, commercial property, but not in a person's primary residence. By doing this, it would only be on loans that would otherwise go into foreclosure, and it benefits anyone with no tax dollars. The person could stay in their home. It avoids the foreclosures that lower surrounding property values, and the lender gets at least as much money as they would in a fire sale. So that's one thing, but not alone. They need to pass the FHA provision. They need to do many things. A lot of these people, they're beyond help, unfortunately, but we think the bankruptcy fix alone might allow 600,000 people to stay in their homes.
Bert.
The so-called bankruptcy fix would make home mortgages more expensive over the longer term and make
Maybe
it harder for folks with anything but pristine credit to get home mortgages. What we have to realize is that, first of all, real estate is local. Conditions vary greatly from market to market. We are seeing some signs in some markets that home sales are picking back up, that prices are bottoming. There are a lot of folks who are coming in and looking at homes now as possibly attractive investments. And so, to a great extent, the market is working this out, much as it did in Texas in the Southwest during the 1980s, where we had perhaps an even more severe house price deflation than we've had in many areas of the country in recent years.
Congressman Leach.
Well, for the last 3 years, the prediction has been 3 months from now, 6 months from now, home prices will stabilize. That prediction is holding with virtually everyone commenting on finance again today. Whether a year from now, someone will say in 3 to 6 months it'll be better, is anybody's guess.
I hope not.
But it's a little bit like interest rates. You make a great mistake to predict. There are so many factors, and they involve so many other people's decisions that it is a very dicey thing to try to do.
Kathleen?
I just have to correct one thing that my friend Bertie Lee said, and that is the bankruptcy fix would not raise the cost of credit. This would only be on homes that would foreclose anyway. The industry now acknowledges how many those will be, and they've already reflect that in the price of credit. It would be homes that would already go into foreclosure, and you're doing something better. In fact, you might even lower the cost of credit, because instead of having the foreclosure, which lowers surrounding property values and keeps this spiral going, hurts the economy, then the economy causes more foreclosure, you would get a bottom. It's only for a finite number of loans that were made during these years when the really bad products were being sold. It's not open-ended. It is just an industry scare tactic to say that it would raise the cost of credit. It's already reflected in the cost of credit. Those homes would foreclose anyway.
And Kathleen Day has the last word in this discussion. She's with the Center for Responsible Lending. Bert Healy is a consultant in the financial services industry. Congressman Jim Leach of Iowa is currently director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Thank you all so much. We'll continue to talk about this. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.